State of opportunity.
State of opportunity.
I want to be a firefighter.
A ballerina.
I want to be a Batman.
This is State of Opportunity from Michigan Radio. I'm Dustin Dwyer. Yesterday, I had a chance to sit down with libertarian author and commentator Charles Murray. Now, if you've never heard of Charles Murray, trust me, he's had a big effect on our nation's approach to poverty and many other issues. We aired a shortened version of my conversation with Charles Murray. For those of you who wanted more, here is the full audio. So I guess where I wanted to start with your work as it relates to children is on the nature of intelligence. You've written a lot on this topic, and one of the things you've argued is that the most important intelligence to measure when it comes to children, the most important measure of intelligence for their future success is a measure that's best captured by an IQ score. Is that right?
Yeah. If you want to take a single measure of ability that has more predictive power than any other, so I'm just rephrasing it a little more precisely, which is then general mental ability as measured by a good individually administered IQ test is probably the best single measure. That doesn't mean that it dominates. It doesn't mean it's going to be destiny. It's just the most predictive.
And this most predictive measure, though, is not very malleable. In other words, it won't change based on the school system. It's not something that can change over the course of your life too much.
There's very little evidence of that you jack up IQ scores through education. A lot of upper middle class parents are wasting an awful lot of money on private schools, hoping that's not true. But there's a lot of evidence that that when you get to first grade, for most kids, all right, for most kids, what you see is what you get in terms of general mental ability.
So I guess the biggest question this leaves is what you do about it. If you accept that the most important factor for future success is this measure of intelligence, and you can't affect it in huge ways past the age of six or so, what does that mean for how we plan our schools and how we educate our kids?
Well, I'm bridling a little bit at the most important measure of success, because suppose you phrase that differently. Instead of success in monetary terms, or what are the chances of living a happy, satisfying human life, then I'm going to say that IQ score isn't nearly that important. If you want to be a nuclear physicist, you better have high IQ. I couldn't have gotten a BS in physics. I'm not smart enough. I don't cry into my pillow at night because of that. And similarly, with a wide variety of other IQ scores with kids, the objective for all children, whatever their IQ, is the same. Education should bring each child to adulthood having discovered things he or she loves to do and having learned how to do them well. And what that does mean is you do not take a youngster who is really, really good with his hands, really, really good at fixing things, but has low verbal skills. You don't try to make an English major out of him. You build on his or her strengths, and that's precisely what the current educational system refuses to do.
Mm-hmm. And this is something you wrote about in one of your previous books, Real Education. And actually, as I was reading that, and you argue that every kid shouldn't go to college. And I was thinking that was published in 2008. It seems like 2008. I've actually heard more people saying that. You actually hear politicians say that now. Do you think we're moving in the right direction on that?
I think that the conventional wisdom is moving in the right direction. You're right. There are lots more people saying, a BA, what's it really worth these days? I've gotten more extreme since I wrote Real Education. I now commonly refer to the BA as the work of the devil. But the reason I do that is because it is a meaningless degree. If the only thing you know about a person is that they hold that piece of paper called a BA, you don't even know if they can write a coherent sentence. If it turns out that BA is from Michigan and it's in mathematics, yeah, you know more. But the BA itself has taken on this artificial status that classifies you as a first-class citizen. Or to put it more precisely, if you're only a high school graduate, you are a second-class citizen.
And you think that stigma is still there and it's still hurting kids?
Absolutely. there is both a resentment and a defensiveness about an awful lot of people, young people who have not gotten BAs, because such a large proportion do now. It's not like the old days where you had, you know, 5% of the population, maybe 10% had BAs. Then the vast majority of people didn't have them, and it was taken for granted that most people didn't get them. Now you've got to have a really good excuse if you don't have a BA, because otherwise you must be a dummy in the way that the popular culture looks at things now.
Mm-hmm. So another thing I want to talk about is some other research into sort of what it takes to have academic success. And there's a new book coming out by a journalist named Paul Tuff, and he talks a lot about work that's been done by James Heckman at the University of Chicago that looks at something that they call non-cognitive skills, that James Heckman calls non-cognitive skills. Things like character, things like persistence and hard work. These are sort of skills that you talk about a little bit in Coming Apart. Do you think that our education system should focus more on those types of skills?
Short answer is yes. I think that what the education system can do is be a kind of practice ground for adult life. And part of that in the educational system should be, for example, learning how to show up the same time every morning, even if you don't feel like it, and do what the teacher says. In the same way, you got to do that in a job. Because what employers will tell you now over and over again, particularly of high school graduates, is they care nothing at all about the high school transcript. What they do care about is whether the employee will show up on time every day and be able to deal with a supervisor-subordinate relationship and do an honest day's work. And those are skills that the schools can teach. And frankly, they used to teach them a lot better than they do now.
Mm-hmm. And are you also persuaded by the evidence that skills like that will lead to higher academic achievement, and even for those students who do go on to a four-year college, that it will lead to better graduation rates? I mean, is that a place where we can move the needle?
But with this proviso, look, you've got this thing called general mental ability, or more specifically, you have visual spatial skills, which are good for the humanities and social science majors, and you've got visual spatial skills. Did I say that? I'm going to start that sentence. I think I got. I mean, so you've gotten your question, and I'm just going. Yeah. Of course it will, but you've got to remember that you have these general mental abilities known as verbal skills and visual spatial skills. And so ability to work hard, character, persistence, all of those are really valuable, but in the context of what you can do with those basic skills. Let's go back to the idea of majoring in physics. And I could not have gotten a BA in physics. I'm not smart enough in those kinds of skills to have done that, no matter how hard I worked. So it would be really stupid for me to go into physics. But if I'm going into history, because I have high verbal skills, how hard I work and my persistence and the rest of it will make a big difference in how well I do in history.
Mm-hmm. So getting into your newest book, Coming Apart, you write about, it's interesting that there's sort of agreement now on both sides of the political aisle about the trends that are happening in America. We're sort of splitting. Mm-hmm. But it still seems like there's two different discussions about why that's happening and how that's happening. Can you tell me about why you took your approach at looking at this problem and what you think of sort of the other approaches, say Timothy Noah's book, The Great Divergence, and other people who sort of looked at this problem of a nation that's sort of being torn apart?
I think the others, I think people on the left are a lot more worried about income inequality than I am. I'm worried about cultural divergence in America's civic culture. I think that my focus on human flourishing in terms of the domains of family, community, vocation, and faith, which I argue are the domains within which people achieve deep satisfactions in life, is somewhat different from the near obsession with just simple income inequality. So in those regards, we're different. In terms of causes, the 1960s have a lot to answer for. We changed the rules of the game that created a lot of the problems we have now. Others will make the argument about globalization, that the good jobs have gone away, and the rest of it. I think I'm right, but you know what? It doesn't make much difference anymore because the whatever the original causes were, they have been overtaken by changes in the culture. Let me be specific. You have lots of men now who are unemployed and out of the labor force who no employer will hire because you hire them and you know it's going to be a failure. You know the guys are going to drift away and not show up on the job. You know that they aren't going to work hard. You don't want to hire them. Okay, was that because of social programs which have made them that way, or is it because of globalization and their demoralized workers? Who cares at this point? Because you can't unwind whatever the original causes were. What you have now is a male who, in terms of the job market, is feckless. And we don't know how to cure that, either with reversing the clock in the way I'd prefer or reversing the clock in the way the left would prefer.
Well, can we narrow the question and say, skip this generation? What about the next generation? What do we do next?
Well, I'm on record arguing that we should replace the entire system of income transfers with guaranteed income. Mind you, the key word there is replace. It's not an add-on. And the reason I want to do that is to bring into play again all of the dynamics of community and personal relationships that can get, for example, young men to be job ready. And I spend a book, the book is called In Our Hands, came out several years ago, trying to explain why a basic income, but without the apparatus of the welfare state, could plausibly do that. So that would be my preferred solution. I think that any solution will have to pay a whole lot of attention to fundamental human drives, fundamental human incentives that go way beyond simple economic dynamics.
Mm-hmm. I think when I have to think, say that when I look at it, it seems like one of the kinks is that it takes one thing to motivate an adult, it takes another thing to sort of take care of a child. And you've argued many times, and I think a lot of people agree, that social programs can create a dependency and that they can sort of take the value out of hard work in certain cases. But then if you look at a program like food stamps or even Medicaid, a lot of the people who benefit from those things are children. And most people would agree that the children shouldn't suffer the consequences of a parent's bad decision or a parent's fecklessness, as you say. Mm-hmm. So in that ways, how do we secure a certain standard of life and opportunity for children without enabling adults and creating a mess?
You don't. You're talking about a built-in set of dynamics that no clever social designer, program designer can get around. Look, we know a whole lot about the role of the two-parent family in socializing children. And I will make the caveat, do some single women raise wonderful children? Absolutely, okay. As far as we know, the advantages of growing up in a two-parent family are such that there is no way to counterbalance them with interventions from outside. As long as we have this huge proportion of children growing up in single married families, the children of those families will tend not to do well. And the reason those single-parent families exist ultimately goes back to a very hard fact. They exist because they can exist. And in a society in which having a baby without a husband is a catastrophe, both financially and in terms of social stigma, you have incredibly high proportions of children being raised in two-parent families. That is a message which is not right-wing ideology. It is consistent with all the data we know, including, you know, there are a lot of people on the left who study these data who don't like to say it the way I just said it, but it's true. So it's a dilemma. It's a dilemma for which there is no good answer.
Mm-hmm. Make sure I understand what you're saying. You're saying if we sort of get away from the business of trying to social engineer people that that, in fact, there will be more children raised in two-parent homes.
Well, let's go to the what would happen if we had a basic income that was given to everybody over the age of 21, which I proposed, and a man is has fathered a child. Well, part of the system says that the money for his basic income is deposited electronically into an account every month. Well, if you know a father of the child, enforcing child support becomes real simple. You just debit that payment. All at once, the financial costs of bringing a child into the world, if you're a man, have suddenly gone up. Similarly, the woman can make demands on the man because the woman knows that he has an income. He can't say, honey, I'd like to help, but I don't have any resources. So you can reinstitute dynamics that would re-energize a lot of the ways in which women would get men to behave better and still have a support system. It is a radical change from the system we have now, but I think it has promise.
But still, none of it forces the father to be a father. It forces him to be financially
responsible. That's none of it forces him to be a father. It starts to set up dynamics. There's My Fair Lady has as one of its main characters the dustbin guy, Doolittle, who is a ne'er-do-well, and then he gets a large legacy from a philanthropist in the United States, and he is forced into middle-class morality because now he has money, and the women he hangs out with start making demands on him. The Doolittle effect is what I have in mind in saying that you might be able to resuscitate a larger sense of responsibility that men are required to take.
Mm-hmm. So I guess, but even in that scenario, the number of children raised in a single-parent household wouldn't be zero. And
no.
There would still be some work left to do, right?
I mean, right.
So then whose responsibility is that, and what do we do about that?
Well, I'm not talking about actually financial difficulties at all for the single woman who has a baby. I mean, under the guaranteed income plan I'm talking about, she's still got the money. The problems that children face in single-parent households are not economic. It turns out that children need fathers. Boys are socialized in large part by watching what their dad does. And if they don't have the dad, guess who they pick on to imitate? They pick on older adolescent boys, the worst possible role models. Young women, girls, are protected from early sexual activity in large part by the father playing the role of the first boyfriend. Also the father playing the role of giving the young woman a chance to say, my daddy would kill me if when she's confronted by an importunate male. Financially, it's real easy to make sure that every child has the financial wherewithal to live a decent existence. That is trivial compared to the problems raised by family breakdown.
Mm-hmm. I guess I feel like I should stipulate that certain people would disagree with you on some of those gender roles, but I don't want to go too far down that road. So let's let that lie.
Some people disagree with me very vehemently.
Yeah, on many points, including that one. But so one of the questions that's left, and we talk a lot in this project about economic opportunity or economic mobility, and specifically intergenerational economic mm-hmm. mobility. And the stats are there that people who are raised poor, and certainly people who are raised in single-parent households, they're more likely to stay poor as adults. 40% of people who are born, whose parents are in the sort of bottom quintile economically, they will remain in that bottom quintile as adults. Only 4% of those people ever make it to the top. Are those troubling things? When you look at economic mobility statistics in America, those things trouble you.
Sure, and those are symptoms of larger problems. It is not the case that they don't get into the upper middle class or the middle class, because even though they pound on doors and try to get jobs and they try to move up the ladder, they are fail because they wear a little sign in their head saying, I'm the child of a single-parent home. What happens is children from single-parent homes are very much more often, especially males, much more often not job-ready. They don't know how to hold a job. And that is a consequence of that is much lower economic mobility.
We touched earlier on this idea of income inequality. Do you think there's a connection between income inequality and economic mobility?
Nah. No, I don't. I'm trying to think of a rationale for why there would be. In one sense, economic inequality would, I think, probably provide a spur. I mean, I just don't see the relationship.
Mm-hmm. So I guess the reason I brought it up is when you look at economic mobility, and this has been brought up to me by people who've studied this, that, and you compare nations on economic mobility, I think we all know that the United States ranks pretty low on economic mobility. Nations,
now, as opposed to earlier.
Right. But nations that rank high are nations where there is less income inequality. And so plenty of social scientists and those who have talked to me say, look, there's a correlation here. Nations that have low income inequality have high economic mobility, and they think that is so. So they think there's a connection.
Well, I'll tell you what I think. Why I think we have lower social mobility than we used to is that America has been a much more efficient meritocracy for much longer than any of the Western European countries. We started getting really, really good at identifying talent wherever it was and shipping it off to college in the 1950s. That's more than half a century now. We got really good at that. And that's now been going on for so long that we are demonstrating the inevitable effect of really efficient meritocracies. At the beginning, there's a whole lot of churning, because you have all this talent that's been in the working class, the lower middle class, and so forth, that's finally getting a chance to rise. And they succeed. And guess what? Once they succeed, who do they marry? Well, the guy marries a classmate at this good college. He becomes an executive in a company. He marries the woman who's an attorney in the legal department. Their kids are in the upper middle class, the next generation, very efficiently. If you do that over time, the churning starts to subside, and you get more of a layer cake phenomenon. The United States has been a much more efficient meritocracy for much longer than any other country in the world.
So this gets at some of the issues that you talk about in Coming Apart, that more highly educated people are pairing up and lower educated people are pairing up. And so then I want to ask again, so what do we do about that? How do we undo that? Or are we destined to be a nation where there's sort of we could call it a ruling class, an elite, who are highly educated and have high incomes, and a perpetual lower class? Is it just going to go that way, or are there actual things we can do?
Well, we have alternative futures, and one is pretty close to the way you described it. And if you asked me to bet, I would say that's the most likely. Look, social democracy of the European type is absolutely the most comfortable solution for the upper middle class, who doesn't want to get directly involved in the lives of their neighbors. They don't want to live in variegated communities with all kinds of different people. They don't want to help their fellow human beings on a retail basis. It's much more comfortable to pay your taxes and to have an advanced welfare state, which also turns out to be the kind of class society over the long run that you just described. One of the great things about the United States historically was people all wanted to say they were part of the middle class. And that included the rich people who would insist, I'm just one of the guys. And that is not nostalgia. That was really true. That is really no longer true. And so the question is, can you resuscitate an American civic culture which prided itself on being engaged in the life of the community, which prided itself on an egalitarianism in terms of human dignity? And that's why I'm a libertarian, because I think the only way to get back to that is to get the government the hell out of the things that have destroyed that civic culture.
So I'll just ask one follow-up on that, which is, and I felt like I was left with this question in the book. Like, I still don't understand the mechanism by which that happens. You're saying if we get the government the hell out of these issues, that people will just naturally go back to neighborhoods where a rich person lives next to a poor person and where they care more.
That won't necessarily happen, but the communities themselves revitalize. To tell you the truth, a working-class, a middle-class community doesn't need these overeducated elitist snobs in order to function. But it does need the kinds of natural incentives to form a vital community, which the welfare state ravages. I mean, if you can send the problems downtown to a bureaucracy, you don't need a functioning community. You can have community consist of backyard barbecues together and no more meaningful interactions. If problems can only be solved by the community, then, lo and behold, human beings are really good, and especially American human beings have been really good at forming extremely vital communities at all economic levels.
But they've also been really good at ignoring problems. I mean, if you're in a gated community, it's really easy for you to just pretend the problem isn't there.
The gated community is the symbol of a community which no longer has any important functions to fill. American communities did not used to be gated communities. The reason why the people in the upper middle class and the elite should quit living in their gated communities and in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and other extremely stratified communities is because it's a lot less fun to live in a nice, glossy place like that than it is to be engaged in a community in which real stuff is going on.
But it's a lot more comfortable. It's a lot more comfortable to never have to acknowledge certain problems or acknowledge different points of view. And that's why we've done it. I mean, it's been a trend that's been happening for 50 years.
And that's why my book was not addressed to government policy changes. It's addressed to an upper middle class audience. And I'm saying to them, you have a variety of lifestyle choices you can make that'll make your life a lot richer. You aren't doing it to be good. You aren't doing it to be humanitarian. I'm talking about your own self-interest. That was my message. And the reason you ought to change your lives is you will lead more satisfying lives.
Okay, so then let's end with this. Just one last. So to the person who listens to this, who's concerned about these issues and wants to see better opportunities for kids, particularly kids on the lower end of the income scale, what is the thing that they can do, a practical thing that they can do today or tomorrow or in the next year to really make this change?
Well, I'm...
Don't say vote Republican. we'll assume you say
that. No, you have to vote Libertarian.
Vote Libertarian. What else should they do?
One of the hardest things about the problem of children is that nobody wants to see children hurt. And so therefore, no one wants policies which they fear will create more immediate suffering today among children. Very natural phenomenon. If you are also in a position where you can look back historically and say, guess what? We have a lot more human suffering and human needs among the generation of children being born now in this vastly richer country than we did 50 years ago in terms of children being raised in ways which would help them flourish. If you come to grips with that, then you have to start thinking about how do we end up in the long run with fewer children suffering? And what drives people nuts is the answer to that question may be changes in society which will cause increases in the short term. I don't believe that to be essential, but I don't think you can advocate the kinds of changes I advocate without understanding that it is a possibility.
That things will get worse for kids.
For the short term. Mm-hmm. I don't believe that's essential, but I think you have to recognize a possibility.
Okay. With that, I'll say thank you, Charles Murray,
for
joining us.
Support for State of Opportunity comes from the W.K. Kellogg Foundation, a partner with communities where children come first.